We're back on the Bengals Beat podcast. I'm Lindsay Patterson, Tyler Dragon, Charlie Goldsmith. How you guys doing?
I'm doing better than BJ Finney's doing right now because I have a job. How are you guys doing?
Good. I mean, I don't want to compare my wellness to a player, but if I would, I'd be about maybe like a Giovanni Bernard right now, maybe a Xavier Suofilo. So things are going pretty well.
Gio Bernard feels like he's played for the Bengals my whole entire life. He's just that guy. He's been here for a really long time. When it comes to BJ Finney, though, you guys, all of that stuff is really to be expected when you think about the Bengals salary cap position of just saving. And honestly, he wasn't really a big impact last year. I know it's easy to point at the Carlos Dunlap trade. I still think it was a good idea to trade Carlos Dunlap, and I really don't want to go down that road. But when you look at BJ Finney and just moving on and making more room, this is going to be one of many for the Cincinnati Bengals.
Yeah, the team saves over $3 million by releasing BJ Finney. So they do get some more room under the salary cap so they can be active in free agency. You mentioned Carlos Dunlap. The Seahawks clearly won that trade. I mean, Carlos, he had a huge impact with Seattle as soon as he joined the team, and they didn't win a playoff game, but they were very happy to have him, and he's going to be there next season as well. But for the Bengals, yeah, it's all about saving money. As you said, Lindsay, he did not have an impact at all. With the team, he appeared in just one game with the Bengals and didn't really do anything. So it was an expected move. It's a move that saves the Bengals $3.2 million. So they can use that money to sign players in free agency, or like I've been saying all offseason, retaining some of their top talent. And first in that list is Carl Lawson.
There's a lesson here too. And first of all, you know, I hope Finney finds a situation that's good for him. I hope he's able to keep playing. It's always, there's always a downside of it too, when just a player gets cut and has to change organizations. But from a Bengals perspective, here's the lesson. BJ Finney was a backup in Pittsburgh who then signed, I believe, a 3-year, $15 million deal in Seattle. Clearly, you know, he didn't start in Seattle. Then he gets traded to the Bengals, doesn't really make an impact on the Bengals. It's kind of an example that when you sign an offensive lineman who during his career has mostly been a backup, there's risk. It's almost like a relief pitcher in some sense. In baseball, you're not quite 100% sure how it's all going to translate. So now looking forward with the Bengals on the horizon of potentially adding more additions to the offensive line, I think BJ Finney kind of is an example. You have to really get a starter and not kind of bank on someone improving like maybe Seattle did with BJ Finney.
Yeah, and I think I wouldn't be surprised if it's late in the draft or early, depending on where the Bengals want to go when it comes to the center position. I know we talked about it on the podcast last week. And Tyler, I know your sources said that Trey Hopkins could be ready for the July camp. I'm always going to wait and believe it when I see it. So I wouldn't be surprised if they add more depth at the center position. But you're right, Charlie, you got to stop getting those backups and start bringing in some starters. So going and moving on to free agency right now, it officially begins a week from next Wednesday. But some big names are getting cut and a lot of teams are trying to make room. It's only the beginning of that. We'll start to see that next week too. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear more from the Cincinnati Bengals. One thing you always see on social media is it's a big name or a connection to Cincinnati and they get released. And you should the Bengals sign him? Should they bring him in? You hear a guy like Kyle Rudolph, plenty of tight end talk recently surrounding the Bengals with the unknowns of CJ Uzomah. And obviously they do have Drew Sample. You look at the guard position, there are rumors that they're going to move on. The Giants are going to move on from Kevin Zeitler. I think it's worth a look. I think they've been trying to replace Kevin Zeitler since the day he left. I think that's more of a cap situation, and that's why Kevin Zeitler has been moved around from Cleveland and the New York Giants. So I still think that's a look. If you're the Cincinnati Bengals right now, you're in good position when it comes to some of these big name guys getting released.
Yeah, the Bengals are going to have around $40 million to play with in available cap space. So I think that they can be really active in free agency. And first and foremost, we've heard it from offensive line coaches. We've heard it from a lot of people coming from the Bengals organization that they want to upgrade that offensive line. So in order to do that, I definitely think that they should add in the interior of their O-line. And you have a guy like Joe Tooney, who's out there, Brandon Sheriff. Those are probably the two best guards available that the Bengals can go after and, you know, pay money to. We've looked at the Bengals' history. They don't really like paying the guard position. They did give Xavier Suofilo money last year. So I do expect him to be plugged in at one guard position and start week one. However, that other guard, it was in flux last season. You know, you had Michael Jordan playing, you had Quentin Spain playing. So that's going to be interesting to see who's going to be inserted in that other starting guard spot. And I expect the Bengals to be active in free agency with guard and also defensive line, defensive tackle and defensive end. Carl Lawson, as I just said before, is number one on the list, but you have some other pass rushers out there that the Bengals can, you know, throw money at and, you know, talk to and bring in. Shaq Barrett's one of the top of the names on the list. He's going to get top dollar in free agency. So I do not expect him to wind up in Cincinnati, but the Bengals, like you said, they do have a lot of money. They have cap room and they can sign some of these marquee free agents. But I do expect them first and foremost to look at their roster at hand right now and see who they want to re-sign. And Carl Lawson, William Jackson III, those are two names that I keep on hearing. I don't know if they're going to be able to sign them both. William Jackson is going to command a lot of money in the open market too, and he might want to go elsewhere. So it's going to be interesting. A week from Wednesday, March 17th, that's when free agency officially begins. And I expect the Bengals to be players. I don't expect them to just sit in their hands and watch. They were active last offseason. I expect them to be active this offseason as well.
Almost as valuable as the ample cap space Cincinnati has is sweet, sweet playing time. In a cap-strapped sport, excuse me, if you're a guy like, say, Kevin Zeitler, and you're cut by the Giants, it's probably very important to you that you can go to a place where there's an opportunity. And across positions even, I've argued this in the Bengals free agency previews I've done, the Bengals really can offer starting positions at every position, but quarterback, running back, safety, and maybe you could argue tight end. Other than that, the board is wide open. We've relitigated this conversation millions of times about the offensive line and free agency and the investment they can make. I've kind of concluded that what I will kind of judge the Bengals off is if they invest average resources in their offensive line. I think that is something that would necessitate a leap from what they've done in the past couple of years. And aside from that, if they have an average cap on the offensive line, they're still going to have the opportunity to address the rest of the team across the board. So, again, the question is what they'll do first in free agency. But as we see more names like Zeitler and just across the board pop up, it's important to remember that the Bengals kind of have the best of both worlds and that they can offer basically guarantee both playing time and resources almost as much as any other team.
I will say this internally. I do know Kevin Zeitler loved his time in Cincinnati and he's not ruling out a return to Cincinnati. But when you look at the AFC North right now, and there was news yesterday, and we've actually talked about this for a couple weeks, obviously ranking the quarterbacks is something a lot of people like to do in all divisions. And the Steelers were in a bad situation. They had to restructure Ben's contract if he was going to come back, and they are going to do that. But now when you look at all the quarterbacks in the division, I think that's great news for the Cleveland Browns, the Cincinnati Bengals, the Baltimore Ravens. When you hear Ben Roethlisberger is going to come back, because he's starting to decline. Is he officially the worst quarterback in the division?
Before I answer that, I think we've done this before. And I was asked on Twitter and asked via text multiple times if I could rank the quarterbacks in the division. And I feel like you guys know where I'm going and know what my rankings are. But if I were to rank the quarterbacks 1 through 4, Ben Roethlisberger would be four on my list. Number one would be Lamar Jackson. Two and three, it goes neck and neck. I would probably go with Joe Burrow at number two and then Baker Mayfield at three. However, it's close. If I'm going off of total body of work last year and not just a small sample size that Joe Burrow had, I would probably put Baker Mayfield, but I'm going off of, you know, what I expect next year and years beyond. And I think, you know, Joe Burrow has more potential and a higher ceiling than Baker Mayfield. So I'm putting Joe Burrow at number two, Baker at number three, and Big Ben at number four.
I know that I'm the newest member of this podcast, but I'll rank these quarterbacks now. And then I hope that in this offseason, we can see these guys play more before we revisit this discussion. Because one, it's close, and two, three of these guys are very young, and it could change quickly heading into the or during the 2021 season. Kind of all season, the way I've ranked it since Joe Burrow had his hot start was Jackson, Burrow, Mayfield, Roethlisberger. And that is part of the fun, though, being in a division with three young quarterbacks and one Hall of Fame quarterback. I'm just trying to say that, like, hopefully these quarterbacks don't just keep being compared to each other. It's kind of more fun, I think, to look at where they stand over across the NFL landscape. But that's where I'd have it. Jackson, Burrow, Mayfield, Roethlisberger.
NFL. Lindsay, you have to give us your rankings too, because I know you always try to slide under and not give us your rankings.
I am. I'll just say this. The NFL will forever be a comparison league. And when you look at the rankings, as you both mentioned, these are going to change. They changed before the start of the 2020 season. They're going to change before the start of the 2022 season. And going into the season, what you have now, even though with Joe Burrow, it is a sample size, I have to go Lamar Jackson at number one. It was hard for Baker and Joe at number two and three, but for now, I'd put Burrow at two, Baker at three, but it's close. It's a really close tie there, and you could flip either or. And Ben is just four because he's getting older and, of course, declining when you look at those three quarterbacks. The Steelers are going to have to get one, and I wouldn't be surprised if they get one on day one of the NFL draft because it is a loaded quarterback class, and they have to start thinking about the future because this is probably it. When you're moving on, though, you guys, all the rule changes, my favorite part of offseason right now, there's a couple out there when it comes to overtime, rushing the passer might change. What do you guys think of overtime now? And I personally want a sudden death. I think that's better.
See, I'm the exact opposite. I like the structure of college football's overtime, and I think the NFL should incorporate that. I think each team should start probably on the opposing team's 30-yard line and try to score. And if both teams score in the first possession, then the second possession, they have to go for two if they score a touchdown. And then the third possession, same thing. If both of them score and then score a two-point conversion, then the game's a tie. That's how I've always envisioned it. I know college football goes on and on and on, but I kind of like college football's overtime. That excites me more when I'm watching extra football. So I think college football has the best overtime of all.
And I think the NFL, no offense, has the worst overtime of all. Even Major League Baseball in the last couple of years has started the run around second, which has brought a new life and energy to extra innings. So, again, in the NFL, it's the only sport where overtime basically is the exact same as regulation, and you can't really feel a difference in energy or anticipation. So I agree. No one I've heard has had a convincing argument as to what's wrong with the college overtime system. Speaking of that, though, they did recently make a change to that where I believe after three or four overtimes now, instead of getting the ball in the 30, you get the ball on the 2-yard line. This is the rule in college now. And then you trade 2-point conversions back and forth just to prevent, like, there was a 7 or 8 overtime game a few years ago that led to this change. So imagine that happening in the NFL. You have Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes trading 2-point conversions. That sounds awesome. And I think that part of overtime deserves to be more fun and also even, which the current system isn't. And I think the college overtime system that I'm describing accomplishes that and rewards the best players on the field for doing exciting things.
And if you ask players after the game, they're going to tell you someone needs to win, someone needs to lose. I've never heard one player say, oh, I love the overtime rules. They're perfect. I mean, it's cool if we tie. Everybody wants a change. So if we see that, I wouldn't be surprised going into maybe the following year, but I know it is being looked at. And another rule change we could possibly see next season is roughing the passer. It could get that extra review. I know it's really hard to determine in the NFL right now. Is this a good or bad idea?
Are catered towards the quarterback now. And I really think as a defender, defensive players, they really have a tough time kind of, you know, playing full speed. And once they get, you know, at the point of impact, they have to decipher, okay, how do I hit the quarterback? I can't hit him too low. I can't hit him too high. And you're really protecting the quarterback. All the rules protect the quarterback. And it's almost like pretty soon quarterbacks are going to just have flags on and players are just going to have to rip the flag off and not hit them. And I know quarterbacks don't like to hear it, but they really don't get hit often and hard anymore because all the rules protect them. So I really think that the NFL need not go back to the old days, but they don't have to cater to the quarterbacks as much as they do. I know the quarterbacks get top dollar. They are the ones that are in all the marketing campaigns. They're the ones, you know, that, you know, get $500 million contracts, i.e. Patrick Mahomes. But it's for defensive players, I get it when, you know, they vent to me and talk to me about, man, like, it's hard being a defensive player because, you know, I'm playing full speed and my job is to stop the offense. But when I get to the quarterback, you have to know I can't hit him this way or I can't hit him that way or I'm going to get penalized. And I've seen some penalties where, you know, a defensive player is getting blocked into the quarterback and accidentally hits him low, but then the defensive player is flagged. And even, you know, on passing situations, downfield when defensive players hit tight ends or receivers, it's difficult playing full speed and not, you know, having your launch point and hitting a player and making sure you're not hitting him too high in the head, neck area. And also you don't want to hit him too low because that can injure somebody for his career if you give him a, you know, accidentally injure his knee or his ankle. So defensive players have it extremely hard. I know I kind of got off subject talking about, you know, receivers too getting hit, but for quarterbacks, they are protected a lot. And I really think the NFL needs to look at all players and hear everybody out because it's not just I know everybody says it's a quarterback league, but there are defensive players in the NFL too that you're affecting by all these rule changes, and everybody wants to see points score, but some of us like defense too, and when you're putting all these handcuffs on defensive players, then you're just going to keep on getting these 40 and 50 point games, which, you know, the casual fans like to see anyways. But I really think the rule changes, some of them need to ease up a little bit and give defensive players a chance to succeed.
I'll keep my answer quick. My take on rushing the passer in general is that it's all relative. I went back last week and watched the Bengals-Eagles game, which I think looking back is the most interesting and telling game of the Bengals season. And just the hits that Joe Burrow took and then the question of whether it was late or not, I think he a lot of times didn't get those calls just because the frequency of hits in the first place and addressing the offensive line, creating fewer opportunities where your quarterback's in that position is critical. That's how you get more calls, not by more experience in the league. That was my takeaway, at least rewatching that game.
Normally, we hear about the NFL schedule in early April. Now, it's more than likely going to be early May. And a lot of people are saying it's going to be a 17-game schedule, which I think is great. Players don't really feel the same because all of the contracts and everything like that. But me personally, I think 17 games is better, three preseason games. And honestly, we just watched a season without preseason games, and it wasn't terrible. I know some teams, it took a little while to gel. How do you feel personally about 17 games?
Well, I agree. I don't think there should be an NFL preseason. If there is, two games, certainly not four. but players, most that I talk to, they don't really like the idea of 17 games. And if we're all going to be about the health and safety of players, then adding more games on the schedule is a little counterintuitive, if we're being honest. I know fans want to see more games. Football is the number one sport in America for a reason. Everybody wants to see games. So for a fan and viewing, of course, more football, more football, more football. We have football Monday, Thursday, Sundays, and even some Saturdays now. So fans want to see more games. I get it. For players and that quick turnaround, the human body is tough going from game to game because every player around week four, their body hurts, and it hurts for the rest of the season. So you're going to have bruises. You're going to have nicks. And some players play with fractures. So it's a rough game. If people who have never played won't understand that, but the players, they definitely feel it. And that's why when you get around maybe week 14 ish, the teams that aren't really going anywhere, sometimes they kind of lay down and relax because, I mean, they're just playing for pride and just trying to fight through and get through the season. So it takes a toll on the body. So 17 games, if they do add another game, I just hope they cut the preseason, because that is even more games that is taxing on the body.
Let's talk about the NBA for a second, because it's an interesting comparison. In 2016, in the summer, the NBA instituted a new TV deal that led to the famous cap spike that led KD to go to the Warriors. Aside from KD, what ended up happening was a ton of players who were like mid to lower tier kind of guys got big money. So when the NBA had their cap spike, not every player benefited from it right away. So if the NFL signs this new TV deal, gets increased revenue from a 17th game, I just hope there's some way that every player, even ones currently under contract, can reap some benefit from that, that this wouldn't be a move that solely satisfies owners and television networks. I hope that it's a decision that is as unanimous as possible with the players, if it is a decision that ends up being made. And I hope that regardless, every player is able to benefit from it, because they're ultimately the ones that this impacts the most.
Plenty on Cincinnati.com. Before we get to Tyler's questions of the podcast, I do want to say next week we are loaded when it comes to guests. Daniel Jeremiah will talk about the Bengals number 5 pick. We'll hear from Duke Tobin and a podcast interview with head coach Zach Taylor. For more coming on that front, I know the guys have plenty on Cincinnati.com. We'll get to that in just a moment. Tyler, go with your questions.
So the questions are kind of fun this week. Today we're recording the podcast on a Friday. Coming to America comes out today. This is the original, was one of my favorite movies of all time. So the sequel comes out. It is out today. My first question to you two, first of all, have both of you seen Coming to America, the original one that came out in 1988?
No. And I'm so sad that I haven't. It's just because I have a confession here. And a lot of people who know me, who covered the Bengals, pretty much anybody in the sports world, know that I haven't seen a lot of good movies. I am a slacker on it. If you bring up a classic movie, sports movie, history movie, any kind of movie, I more than likely haven't watched it. And that's just a failure on my part. So no, I haven't watched it.
Oh my goodness. Charlie, please.
I've seen it. It's a very good movie. Yes. Very good movie.
Thank you for saving the day, Charlie. Okay, Lindsay. I asked before the end of the month. I know free agency is going to be wild. Before the end of the month, my homework to you, please watch the original and sequel to Coming to America. You think you can do that?
Done.
Okay. And you have to report to us how you like it.
I will.
All right, Charlie, it's again, we know you're in Arizona. Give us your takeaways from spring training. I know you covered a game out there. Hunter Green, the pitcher, tell us what you saw. What are your takeaways from spring training, Reds?
So 102, 101, 102, 103 miles per hour in consecutive pitches. I think that is the biggest, the most impressive thing of the week. You know, you had people who've been in baseball their whole lives who after the game were saying that that was even fun to watch and something they could appreciate. So Hunter Green is the most fun thing I've seen. And then, hey, TJ Antone, man, he's a relief pitcher fighting for a starting spot, but he's going to be pretty filthy either way. So those have been the two main takeaways from the week.
Okay. And then have you accomplished anything on the to-do list that Lindsay and I have both provided to you?
I've been trying new restaurants as often as I can. I've not gone hiking yet, but there's an off day tomorrow and we'll see what happens.
Okay. That concludes my questions of the week, Lindsay. Sorry I had to leave you out a little bit, but you have homework to watch Coming to America, both of them.
I will. And Charlie, your off day, I'm telling you, you have to take advantage of it. You're going to hit one of the breweries in Arizona. They have plenty near Goodyear, Glendale, and Phoenix. And you have to, at sunrise, sunset, not in the middle of the day, go climb Camelback Mountain or just a mountain nearby. You have to do it. You'll have the best time, the best views. And that's what Charlie has to do. I want one hiking picture from Camelback Mountain. But he has 1 month. He's going to be there till opening day. So he has 1 month to get on Camelback Mountain and he won't regret it. Just pack a bunch of water.
Okay. So this is
what good. What if I hike a very small hill? Does that count?
You could, because it is Arizona. That does count. Just one of them. I want you to be able to see a little bit of a view on top of some city in Phoenix and just pack your water and don't do it in the middle of the day.
You heard it here first, Bengals fans. Charlie has to go hiking before April 1st, and Lindsay has to see Coming to America, the original and the sequel, by April 1st. Homework for Charlie and Lindsay. I can't wait. I'm definitely going to write this down and ask y'all if you guys have accomplished your homework assignments on April 1st.
I can't believe
and let everybody know about it too.
I can't believe you're doing this during, you know, a really busy NFL time. I mean, Charlie's covering the Reds right now and NFL free agency starting to pick up. We'll have plenty on Cincinnati.com.
You gave Charlie an assignment. You told him he has to go climb up a mountain.
That's true. That takes a lot. I will. I'll do my homework and I'm sure Charlie will do his. And one thing I do want to get to right now, Charlie has plenty online from the Reds and the Bengals and NFL free agent tracker. So make sure you're checking that out. Tyler, what's up on Cincinnati.com and a little bit about your interview that you had with the guy who's working out Joe Burrow, Drew Sample, and Akeem Davis-Gaither.
Yeah, on Cincinnati.com, the Bengals have had an active week. They cut center B.J. Finney, as we discussed earlier in the podcast. They re-signed a long snapper, Clark Harris. That's a good move for them. He has had no unplayable snaps since his arriving to the Bengals. So I have those two stories. I have five biggest questions for the Bengals this offseason. Also on Cincinnati.com, they brought in free agent safety Ricardo Allen. The Bengals don't necessarily need a starting caliber safety. Ricardo Allen started for the Atlanta Falcons last year, but Sean Williams and Brandon Wilson, they're entering free agency. So they definitely need a backup safety, both strong safety and free safety. And the Bengals also signed Jalen Davis, the reserve cornerback, to a one-year deal. So all of that is on Cincinnati.com.
And next we have the Bengals beat extra with the trainer Black Sheep Performance, Patrick Coyne. He's been the guy training with quarterback Joe Burrow, Akeem Davis, Gaither, Drew Sample, just to name a few Bengals. We'll also hear from Evan McPhillips when it comes to free agents the Bengals could or should be bringing back in 2021.
So now on the Bengals beat podcast, we have Patrick Coyne. He is the owner and head trainer of Black Sheep Performance. If you read the Inquirer last week, he trains over 20 Cincinnati Bengals, including Joe Burrow, Sam Hubbard, Drew Sample, and many more. He's the head trainer. He's a great trainer. He trained me. So, Patrick Coyne, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today? It's a beautiful day outside, so I'm good.
It is a beautiful day. It's not as cold as it has been in recent weeks, so I'm enjoying that. You know,
me too.
As you're well aware, I'm from California, so I have that Cali blood in me, so I'm not used to the snow.
You and my wife both, man. It's a different world out there. It's a different world.
So, you know, I talked to you at length about, you know, how you started in this training industry. But for the fans who maybe didn't read the article and don't know that much about you, how did you develop a passion for training?
I mean, myself, I think athletes in general, I mean, some athletes don't like to work out. For me, that was kind of my safe haven. It's very, very simply put, lifting weights was an outlet for me. It was a way to take out stress. It was a way to, I didn't do the best in school, learning disabilities and bullied real badly, but when I could walk into the weight room, I thrived. I felt better when I left, and I try to make it as simple as that. So it made me feel really good about myself, but it also improved my quality of life and quality of performance as a human, as an athlete. And I noticed that from a very young age. So I just tried to build off that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started Black Sheep Performance in 2018. How did you come up with the name?
Similar to what I just said. So myself, I've always taken training and goal setting and manifestation and taking yourself at a serious level. I've always been an outlier, say. Mm-hmm. So I've taken it a lot more serious than other people. Mm-hmm. To where as a kid, you take yourself serious, you put things out there, kids who aren't confident are automatically going to lash out. That goes through the majority of life for some reason until like your mid-20s and everyone wakes up and realizes, oh, you actually had your stuff together and have been trying to make something of yourself. But I knew I wanted to help the youth, and I knew I wanted to have a name that could give people an identity. Mm-hmm. And a room full of outliers, a room full of black sheep. So I made it to be not to be that we're all badasses and we think we're cooler than everyone or this or that. It's more of we are black sheep because we're outliers in the world of we take ourselves seriously, we do the right things, we train really hard, we treat people well, that we're the black sheep of our communities. And I think that people have bought into that culture.
Mm, okay. And as I said in the article, and as you've told me, you started training people on the side of your parents' house when you first started the company. Now your gym has evolved to 11,000 square foot facility. What's it been like for you to see your company grow so fast?
I started training people right after I played South Bay football at UC. Went from Denver, learned from a great guy named Lauren Lando and Matt McChesney, went down to Miami Beach, learned from Mark Megna, and then came back up. So I'd worked at big gyms. I'd been working with professional athletes and youth athletes and college athletes. But to move back and do it in my hometown meant everything to me. I knew that it was possible. I knew that Cincinnati was lacking that independent, culture-based, family-based performance center. So I knew we could do it, but I had no clue it happened as fast as it did. So for me, it's almost like watching it from a different perspective. I'm just kind of along for the ride too. Mm-hmm. You know, we put everything we have into every client every day, and then you look up and there's 50 more people that want to get into the gym. There's 100 more people that want to get into the gym. So for us, it's we've been doing the same thing for years, and I think people have just noticed our legitimacy and our passion and what we put behind every single session. Mm-hmm. So it's been the ride of my life, right? It's been awesome.
That's good. And you grew up a Bengals fan. You're still a Bengals fan. Defensive end Sam Hubbard was your first Bengals client.
I was actually just on the phone with him before this phone call.
Oh, really? Well, I won't ask you what you talked about in your phone call, but how did your relationship with Sam Hubbard start?
Sammy and I, it happened very organically. So he's coming back up here in a few days to where I was working out. Cortez Broughton, I believe, who plays for the Chargers, good buddy of mine, former UC Bearcat as well. Sam was doing a photo shoot with my wife and Marcus Rush to promote some D-line training because Marcus and Sam went to Mola together. Saw how I was training Cortez, and Sam simply asked if he could start training and what that entailed or who I even really was. And I told him on the spot, I said, I'll train you right now. And if you know Sam, Sam's that kind of guy. We like action, and that's why we're buddies, but trained him on the spot, and right after that he looked at me and said, what time tomorrow? A few days later he came in with a jersey, and our relationship was solidified. So we've been together for, this will be our third offseason together. Time has flown.
Wow. And now over 20 Bengals have worked out at your gym, including Joe Burrow. What made Burrow start training at your gym?
I mean, in professional athletes, it's just like any realm, whether you're a writer or an artist, or you don't look for outside sources of information and credibility. You look within your circle. So I know Joe is moving back here, coming into the summer. He simply reached out to Sam because he knew that's where Sam trained, and they had a conversation. He introduced him to me, and it was that simple. But in the professional sports world, you have to have results for people in that circle, or it doesn't matter what you do on Instagram or Facebook or marketing, what you even say, it's about what you do. So it was just a genuine relationship, and Sam, just like a lot of other athletes, is funneled people into Black Sheep. So, I mean, I think Sam is the biggest Black Sheep supporter in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question that's on the minds of all Bengals fans and NFL fans in general, what's Joe Burrow's mindset? How's he looking right now at working out?
I think Joe looks great. I think Joe is doing everything he can to get back as soon as he can. And he works every day very, very hard at it. And I think Bengals fans will be excited to know that he puts everything he has into every session. And he's doing everything he can on an every second basis to get back and provide for the city.
Mm-hmm. Now, he said before that, you know, his goal is to be back by week one. Do you think that is a realistic target date based on what you've seen every day in the gym at Black Sheep Performance?
I think it's a negative thing to doubt Joe. So I think if that's what Joe says, I would believe Joe. And if that's what his plan is, so we're sticking to that, and we're going to work every single day to try to make that happen. So I think it's a smart thing to listen to him. So we shall see. Okay. We shall see. I know what we're doing. He's doing everything he can, like I said, on a daily basis. So I don't think the plan has changed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've had a serious knee injury. I'm unfortunately in that club too of serious knee injuries. What's the key to coming back from, say, you know, an ACL tear, MCL tear, anything of a serious knee injury? What's the key to coming back strong from that?
I think, I mean, doing the right things, like doing your due diligence and not looking over any part of rehab. I know he had a good surgeon. I know he's rehabbing very hard. Like I said, you have to do it on a daily basis. It has to be your life to come back from a knee injury. And I think no matter who it is, if it's a seventh grade girl who's tore ACL in soccer and she's looking to get back, I think the most important thing is confidence in that new ligament, in the knee, the structure in the knee that has it healed properly. Are you confident enough to give 100%? Because if not, and you play timid or you create a really bad imbalance in the body, things can get pretty sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, obviously, if you have a good surgeon, a good rehab, following that is kind of trust within yourself and trust within your own body that, you know, you're 100% again. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, most of the time, if it's done the right way, your knee's going to come back even stronger.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you mentioned soccer, because you train more than just football players, right? Is there a sport or sports that you specialize in?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously being a former football player, I have an extreme passion for football. The game has saved my life multiple times, but we have over 17 sports at Black Sheep, ages from 8 to 85 years old, big high school demographic, you know, everything from lacrosse, softball, baseball, basketball, soccer, golf, volleyball, any sport that's a high school level sport, we have athletes that are in our gym. So it's a comprehensive program. We do not tailor just the football players. We do not tailor just the basketball players. We tailor to athletes in general.
Mm-hmm. Now,
absolutely.
Now, do you have clients, you know, who are just, you know, trying to get back in shape or rehabbing from injury, or you know, have clients from all different, you know, sides of the spectrum?
Yeah. So, I mean, return to sport is a big thing. So I know a lot of rec, like we have a lot of golfers, a lot of tennis players, a lot of rec league basketball players, the weekend warrior crowd, if you could say that. So anyone who's looking to move better, to feel better, we think like everyone can train as an athlete. All we do as human beings is we walk, we jump, we sit, we throw, we rotate, we run. We are experts in that. So we try to get people to move better and feel better and be the most optimal version of themselves. So, like I said, we have a ton of weekend warrior clients and a ton of clients who are just trying to get in better shape with a goal in mind. We're a very serious training facility, so it's a very one-on-one oriented basics when you are an adult training for your goals, because we take our job that serious. If you're just looking to get a good workout on the elliptical, Black Sheep isn't the place for you. Now, if you're looking to come have the best workout of your life and really take your performance to the next level, whether you're a CEO, a mom of four, whatever you're looking to do, I think we can help with that. And I know you can attest to that after training with me. So I think that we can cater to anybody.
Hmm. So, you know, if you were to kind of sell Black Sheep Performance and compare it to any other gym in Cincinnati or even Ohio, what makes Black Sheep Performance different?
I have the same answer every time I get asked this question. And I know a lot of people feel the same way. But our culture is different. Every single person that you see walks into the gym exudes Black Sheep. They're a walking billboard for Black Sheep, not just with their clothes, the way they walk into a room. We're in a generation now where people can't look at people eye to eye. People look at their phones. We are a communicative gym. You walk in, there's someone saying hello to you at the front desk. There's someone saying hello to you when you're training. No phones on the training floor. We are looking at you eye to eye. We are creating better human beings, and we treat the human first before the athlete. And I think that no one does it better than us. I think mm-hmm. our culture is second to none, and I think our staff and our team is second to none. So I just think it all starts with the people. It starts with the human beings before the business, before the money, before the results, before the training. I think we have the best humans around, and I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. Well, before I get you out of here, I have to ask you this question, and it might even be the most important question that I've asked you all day. You know, you've trained a lot of people, and you know athletes, and so the last question I have to ask you is, you know, if I wanted to get back and make a track and field comeback, you trained me now, Patrick, so answer good now. If I wanted to make a comeback, based on what you've seen when I train with you, am I past my prime, or is my prime, am I still right in the middle of my prime? Could I make a track and field comeback if I wanted to?
That's like asking if I can make a football comeback. You know, we have the mindset for it. I think at a lower level, back at UCLA, being honest with you, I don't think so. But hey, maybe in that older demographic, but there's not a chance I could go back and play football. So we can do this together, and maybe you can find a, you know, that 28 to 40 year old track league, and I can find that flag football league that we can feel really good about ourselves, and we can roast the competition.
So You basically just told me I'm way past my prime. And
I think you're in your prime for your career in writing, being a great guy, you know, helping the city of Cincinnati out. But I mean, just like myself, I think we're both out of our prime playing on field sports. Do I think you could be in the best shape of your life? I really do. So you know what? Maybe we could flip that. I didn't get to train you before you went to college or when you were in college. So maybe we could make a comeback of the century.
Thanks for the politically correct answer, Patrick.
Hey, you're so welcome. I'm trying.
Well, that is Patrick Coyne of Black Sheep Performance. If you're in the Cincinnati area, I highly recommend this gym. I worked out there. Many Bengals work out there, including Drew Sample, Sam Hubbard, Joe Burrow. I can go down the list. So if you're in Cincinnati, you want a great workout, I recommend Black Sheep Performance. Thanks for coming on the show, Patrick.
Thank you so much, brother.
We're back on the Bengals Beat podcast. Extra edition, had to bring in one of my favorites, Evan McPhillips. Evan, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Lindsay. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, we joked off there, not a whole lot going on as far as updates or news in the NFL world in Cincinnati. A lot going on nationally. It's been a crazy offseason. It feels a little bit like the NBA when it comes to free agency, when it really does start in about 2 weeks. But with the Bengals, a lot of the talk is that number five pick. Last year, from the moment they entered their season, honestly, you could go back to December, the game after they lost to the Miami Dolphins. Everybody knew the Cincinnati Bengals, they were going to draft Joe Burrow with the number one pick. So, you know, you didn't have any mystery of what was going to happen in the first round. It was more focused on the second or third. You look at this draft, there's all kinds of possibilities. And I think, you know, I've talked plenty about different positions of where they should go, where they shouldn't reach. And everybody on Twitter has an opinion about it. At number five, offensive lineman or wide receiver, what are you doing at five if you're the Cincinnati Bengals on day one?
That's a good question. And that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And I think, you know, it's kind of basic really to say that it's determined so much by what happens in front of them, but it really does, because you're hearing things like, especially lately, it's smokescreen season, but you hear Chase's the interest between Chase and the Dolphins is heating up, and maybe they like Sewell, and maybe the Jets feel they're okay at quarterback. So really it depends how that kind of top five plays out. With Sewell or Chase there, I don't think that in this particular draft there's necessarily a wrong way to go, because Chase is such an exceptional prospect who was, again, elite at a young age, dominating players who were already in the NFL now playing. And he was obviously had the connection with Joe Burrow. There's goodwill bought there, and the Bengals clearly need some sort of, not to say that T. Higgins and Tyler Boyd aren't very, very good receivers, but someone who has that number one potential of a wide receiver. And of course, Sewell is a very exceptional young tackle prospect that is still coming into his own. And a lot of people have put out as a quote unquote generational tackle prospect. But fortunately for the Bengals, whether one of the other is available to them or not, fortunately, there are a lot of other tackle prospects and wide receiver prospects that if they do fail to get one, they do have plenty of options, very talented options, to get at the opposite position, whether that be tackle or wide receiver at the top of the second. Now, of course, if a quarterback ends up sliding to them and Sewell and Chase are both gone by their pick, well, that means that Wilson and Fields are probably one of the two are on the board still. And I'd be a huge fan of the Bengals trading back in any scenario where there's still a quarterback on the board to acquire more picks. Because the first thing you say with looking at this Bengals roster, and a lot of people would say, is there's so many holes that any one tackle or Sewell or Chase is not going to fix your problems on offense. You have a whole guard, tackle, cornerback, so you need help at wide receiver. You could really use two corners at this point with only Darius Phillips and Trey Waynes under contract, and also some practice squad players who have not had any NFL snaps. So there's a lot of holes that need to be filled. I think the ideal scenario would be trade back, accrue more picks, and get some very talented players that, while maybe not Sewell or Chase, they are very close to their level, and that the Bengals and their fans could feel really good about that.
I think when you look at the quarterbacks or even the wide receivers that could be taken right before the Cincinnati Bengals pick at number five, they're going to have a huge decision to make if both their guys are there when they're sitting at five. I mean, that even gives them a chance to move back one spot if they're up in the air of who they want to get. They want to go wide receiver. They want to go protection. I think the biggest question is going to get answered in just a few short weeks, deciding on what they're going to do. Last season, the Bengals team spent a lot of money. And it was not like the normal Cincinnati Bengals, the way they were shooting it out there. And unfortunately, they had to deal with some injuries. DJ Reader, they lost him from almost more than half of the season. You look at Trey Wayne, never even got to see him on the field, what he's going to look like out there on the defensive side. And a lot of people point to, what did you do for the offensive line? And now look at where Joe Burrow is right now. He's rehabbing. He's hoping to make it back for week one, to be determined on if that happens. What's going to happen in a few short weeks when you look at the offensive line? And is this team going to value the guard position?
That's a good question. And based on especially some of the interviews that have come out recently with coaches, particularly with Jake and James on the Locked On Bengals podcast, doing a great job with having Brian Callahan on there to talk a little bit about the Bengals and their offseason plans and kind of what they value on this roster. They talked about the offense, recognizing that the offensive line needs to perform better than it did last year. And you'd hope that they would go and use free agency in some of their cap space, especially in a year where many other teams may be kind of hampered by their lack of cap space, to kind of leverage their situation into getting some good talent that would at least maybe not be top tier talent, like say Scherf, who seems to be staying in Washington, or maybe Thuney, who would be, or Joe Thuney, who would be the $15 million per year guard almost, which we know the Bengals don't necessarily value the guard position. I think it's more realistic that they try and maybe target some of those mid-tier to lower tier guards that, while Bengals fans may be kind of rolling their eyes at them, kind of rolling around in the bargain bin, they do keep in mind that the guard position was absolutely atrocious. And obviously there was a revolving door and a lot of injuries last season, but having that consistency from these type of free agents, like a Matt Filer, who's only 28 years old and projected to get $6 million a year, that's right in the Bengals' price range. And he's played right tackle and left guard for the Steelers and has never graded under 65 in four seasons, which I can tell you from looking at the grades, the Bengals guards were constantly under 65 last season. So having that kind of consistency from that guy, or maybe a Larry Warford, if he's amenable to signing with a non-contender, then those would be some options that maybe would be in the Bengals price range that would give them an upgrade, but also not break the bank for them at a position that they tend to not historically value.
I think when you look at the wide receiver room, I know you mentioned T. Higgins and Tyler Boyd, and you ask a lot of other NFL wide receiver rooms if they would take those guys and be okay with a few backups in there. And then the biggest question is not having a number one receiver. And I know you had mentioned that prior, but is that important? Because when you have Joe Burrow out there, he can make anybody look good. He almost had two receivers with 1,200 plus yards if he would have stayed healthy. You put a tight end out there, Drew Sample, he was really getting involved in the offense, to be determined on if CJ Uzomah's on this team next year and how he's doing from recovery of his Achilles injury. But how important is a number one receiver when you have a talent like Joe Burrow?
I don't know that it's as important when you have a talent, as you said, someone who can distribute and read and especially throw his receivers open and anticipate like Joe Burrow does and did his rookie year and in college. And I think that opens things up, but you also need Zach Taylor in the offense to be functioning well as well. But you do see that it does not necessarily matter that you have that number one receiver as long as you have a lot of complementary skill sets. You see it when you look out in San Francisco with Shanahan and you see he's got Debo Samuel, he's got Brandon Ayuk, he's got a different array of receivers at his disposal and he knows how to use them and their strengths well. You see it in Los Angeles with Sean McVay, not to disparage Robert Woods, huge fan of Bobby Trees, but Bobby Trees and Cooper Kupp both share very unique kind of roles that fit the offense well. And at any one time, either guy can look like a number one receiver. So it's more about having those complementary skill sets. And I think anyone looks at the Bengals receiving core and is very impressed with the body control of players like T. Higgins and Tyler Boyd, their ability in contested catch situations, and especially Tyler Boyd's route running and ability from the slot. It's all very impressive, but they also need that little bit of spark, that little bit of explosiveness. And it's not necessarily calling them slow. It's just someone who gives them a little juice after the catch, someone who can give them a deep threat to make them stay honest on the deep end of the back half of their defense. And so fortunately for the Bengals, as I referenced earlier, there's a lot of options that you can find in the second and the third round that would fit that skill set to where you don't need to feel pressured to go get Chase, or maybe you have a guy like a Curtis Samuel in free agency who you feel fills that role nicely, and you don't have to break the bank to say go get him like you would an Allen Robinson or a Kenny Golladay.
If they pick up Curtis Samuel, I think we have a feeling of what they're going to do with a number five pick, even if Sewell's not there, if they draft down to get Rashawn Slater. But I think that's going to be telling, and we're a few short weeks away from finding that out. But I'll flip to the defensive side internally. When you look at a guy like Carl Lawson, obviously this team had trouble getting to the quarterback last year, and Carl Lawson was part of the MVP when you flipped the other side. There's a chance to re-sign him. A lot of people want to use the franchise tag on him or William Jackson III. I think they're going to part ways with one of them, and I'm leaning towards keeping Carl Lawson. What do you think is going to happen?
So obviously the Bengals have the money, but whether or not they want to spend that, and that's always a thing, is that, you know, people sometimes forget, myself included, to wrap their head around, is just because there's cap space doesn't mean necessarily they want to spend it without having a purpose. And sometimes I can feel like the franchise tag might be that. For a guy like William Jackson, I know the talk is that maybe he's the less desirable option to bring back. I know a lot of people love Carl Lawson. I know that the organization loves him. And not to say they don't love William Jackson, but it seems that they're really trying to get a job or a deal done with Carl Lawson. Looking at the WAR, the wins above replacement, William Jackson has been slightly more valuable than Lawson, but a lot of that comes from the position he plays and the value of the secondary and the plays that he has made. The problem is that as soon as you let William Jackson walk, you don't have three corners with NFL experience. You have Darius Phillips and Trey Waynes, and Trey Waynes is a solid corner, but not necessarily a guy you want covering a team's number one constantly, or you don't have a corner that you feel comfortable covering the team's deep threat, because Trey Waynes and Phillips, especially Phillips, is maybe not the most athletic corner there is. So you need to have at least three or four corners. And if you let William Jackson leave, you've only got two with real NFL experience. He's the top free agent corner, and you may not want to overpay him, whether that's $13 million a year or $15 million a year. But if you don't pay him, then you have a sudden desperate need at the cornerback position, and you don't want to rush and overpay somebody. So looking at PFF's rankings, there's a lot of slot cornerbacks out there available, but the next best outside cornerback by PFF standards is Shaq Griffin, who's ranked 37th in the free agent rankings. He's got his own injuries and consistency concerns of his own, and he's projected at least $10 million. So if he doesn't get overpaid and gets what he's expected, he's only $3 million cheaper maybe than William Jackson. At that point, I want to pay William Jackson. He's a homegrown commodity. It shows other free agents that end draft picks that you will take care of your own. It's a homegrown talent, which the Bengals harp on. They all constantly want to bring back their homegrown talent. It's an opportunity to pay one of their own who's done well. He's a little bit older. He's 28 already, but still, he's solid. You need corners. You know what you have in him. You are familiar with his skill set and how to utilize him. This is not to say that Carl Lawson is not important. Obviously, the Bengals do not have edge depth behind him. They have to sign him. They have options out there in the edge class, but they're going to have to overpay for something unproven or with some questions, like a Jadeveon Clowney or like a Yannick Ngakoue. That doesn't seem to be what the Bengals want to do. They want to save that money to pay their draft picks, to extend Jesse Bates, to pay Carl Lawson, and hopefully William Jackson is in there. If not, they're going to have to hammer cornerback in free agency and the draft with at least two cornerbacks. But they should at least bring back William Jackson and sign a slot corner, whether that's Mackenzie Alexander or one of the other cornerbacks like a Desmond King. Maybe one of these cornerbacks wants to be on a one-year deal, and you can sign them and then let them sign for a more expensive deal after this year when the cap goes back up, and maybe you even get a compensatory pick from it. So there's a lot of options, but what they can't do is just leave the secondary on an island with just two players in Darius Phillips and Trey Waynes trying to hold it down. That's unfair to ask them to do, and the Bengals absolutely need that corner depth, because if one of them goes down, they're in a really, really tough spot.
NFL, I mentioned it's been a wild offseason when you look at all of these player moves, who's going where. J.J. Watt, $31 million, two-year deal, $23 million guaranteed to go to Arizona. Are you paying that?
That's a lot. And it is J.J. Watt, and they desperately needed some interior line help. But That's a hefty price tag. Again, it comes down to if the owner has the money and if the team has the money, if they want to spend it, if they feel like it's helps them to win and it's something that they feel comfortable in doing, then by all means. But that's a hefty price tag to be paying for an aging veteran. But if they feel like this is their window, I think there's some people who would disagree that the Cardinals are a JJ Watt away from getting to where they need to be, especially in such a competitive division. But I don't know. It's a little pricey for what I think I was expecting.
Evan McPhillips, we're going to have you on again. Plenty to talk about NFL news. It's just starting. There's no offseason when you look at the NFL world to be determined on where the Bengals go in free agency and with that number 5 pick. Thank you for joining us.
I appreciate you having me, Lindsay. Thanks.